The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You're listening to the Best Morning Routine Ever podcast, the show that proves no one stumbles upon success ever. With your host, Lou Need. Every Mondays and Thursdays, we deliver cold hard evidence behind the power of a robust morning routine. Get ready to be transformed by the renewal of your mind.
Hello, morning enthusiasts. Welcome to the Best Morning Routine Ever podcast. I am your host, Looney Lewis. And today I have the honor of introducing a very special guest to the show. It is going to be quite an episode. I want to bring on today Dr. Joshua Swamidas. He is super unique. He's a PhD artificial intelligence scientist and a medical doctor who wants to help us have better conversations about more of the difficult subjects around race, religion, artificial intelligence, AI itself, and science. And Josh, he's a Christian, a scientist, and he sees no conflict between the two. Now, he believes he can help all of us take some of the sensationalism out of the hot topics and build a better, more meaningful discussion and understanding around it. So it's no further ado, Dr. Joshua, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me here.
It is a delight. I'm super excited that you decide to join us and make the time to talk to us. Now, I am really excited to hear about the science. We love talking about science and the background behind science and the habits and the body and the mind. But before we get into that technical stuff, let's talk about your journey a little bit. Tell us about who you are and your journey thus far.
Yeah, so I'm a scientist. I work at Washington University in St. Louis. It's a leading science institution. I run a NIH-funded group using artificial intelligence to answer questions about medicine and biology and chemistry. It's been a really fun thing to take something as crazy as artificial intelligence to go discover new things about the natural world. That's really what I do and what I've really found myself in. But then also I kind of got sucked up into these grand questions about what it means to be human. Yeah. Thinking about human origins, thinking about, if AI could ever have a mind of its own, and if you could ever actually have like a conversation with a person that is actually an artificial person, and what makes us different than other animals, and all those sorts of questions, that grand question, they all bring us back to of what it means to be human. And so I've been having a lot of fun, writing stuff for the broader audience and engaging the public around that question too.
Yeah. What sparked your interest in both AI and being a medical doctor?
Well, I wanted to be a medical doctor to help people. My mom worked out in like the rural areas of India, before I came here. I was born in the United States, but I heard stories about that. And there's something so compelling about actually using medicine to help people. The problem is that I don't know if I would have made it a very good clinical doctor. I mean, I did go to medical school, but I found out really early on as a pre-med that I really liked science. I was really, really made for and drawn to science. Yeah. In particular, I really liked the computer program and software program. I didn't want to be just making web pages and websites or dealing with the pure world of, math that you see in some computer science. And right at the time I was going to graduate school, there was this new field that arose called computational biology. Turns out that biologists were starting to encounter tons and tons of data that we really hoped to be helpful for treating patients, but really required new algorithms and new mathematical approaches to really address. And it just turned out I graduated at just the right moment to enter that field.
That's good for you, because data scientists is huge now. It started coming up on being able to read data and let it interpret it, and so that it tells a story.
Yeah, it's mainstream now, but I graduated in the year 2000. So that was like two decades ago, and it wasn't mainstream.
You pioneered. You were part of the group to pioneer it.
when I used to tell people that's what I was doing, decades ago or wanted to do it, I would get a lot of very quizzical, confused looks. And frankly, even just, you know, a year before, I would have didn't even know that really it was an option, right? But now, nowadays, it's like, well, of course that's what people should do and are doing, right? It's just that I happen to have been lucky to graduate at just the right moment to be one of the leaders in that field.
Yes, good for you. And I'm glad I have you on here because I saw Coded Bias yesterday on Netflix.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so that's one of the questions I think is really important to talk about too, race. So Coded Bias is about how artificial intelligence can have bias. And, you know, we're about to publish a paper specifically on how to make neural networks more fair. It's called FairNet. So that's not published. It's going to be in archive server by next week, actually. I'm really excited about that. And that brings us back to the question of what it means. Are we all the same? Are we different? I mean, clearly there's differences between humans, but how different does that make us? And how good is the technology we make at navigating those differences in a sensible, humane way?
You know what's crazy? They are very important questions. But you know what's crazy, Dr. Joshua?
You were just lost in thought there for a moment.
I was, because I'm ready. I'm ready to have this conversation with you right now. I'm getting myself ready because what I've found, and I dabbled in data science for a while, and what I noticed, is, especially when it comes to machine learning and how it is flawed, is, well, whoever's designing the machines, because data machine works where you're feeding it tons and tons of the data so that it can read it. If you wanted to recognize your face, you're going to give it a tons and tons of pictures to look at. Well, if that data, the information is being fed is already biased, if it's because we're human by nature, we're biased by nature.
Well, because reality is biased to start out with. I mean, there's going to be different proportions of different sorts of people in any sample you draw.
Yeah. And so we're finding that. So the machines that we are creating to automate and help the humanity and help us progress, it's not very different from how we were doing things, because the way we're thinking in terms of the bias or the prejudice.
Well, I would say is that unlike many examples in history of when new technology was introduced, in this case, people are looking very closely at the questions of equity and fairness and justice. That's different. And so we're kind of identifying issues before they come into wide practice in a way that maybe hasn't happened before. So I'm maybe more hopeful. I think none of this stuff is inherent to artificial intelligence. There's ways to overcome it if we're looking for it and we care to. And I think that is exactly what's happening now. We are looking for it and we care to overcome it. And I think we have an opportunity that maybe we will.
I absolutely hope so. Tell us about the term, the black box.
It's a black box means that it's one way of thinking about deep learning, which has a lot of problems with it, where you just think because you gave it a ton of data, the algorithm, and you don't even understand how it works, that's the black box piece. But you just trust the fact that you gave it a lot of data to say that it'll work really well. But the fact of the matter is that model of machine learning doesn't work. And people are moving away from that. And in fact, particularly in questions like encoded bias, where this had to do with facial recognition, right?
Yeah.
And there was a scientist that found a very simple test that actually we could have predicted before she did it what the result would be, is that it was much worse at classifying whether or not black people were male or female than it was classifying whether or not white people were male or female. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't because of any intrinsic bias in the code. It had to do with the fact that the images presented to the algorithm were primarily white people. So it got really good at classifying in that domain, but not very good at classifying in another. Now, once you know to look for it because you care, there's actually some very clear ways to fix it.
Well, that's
and,
good.
You know, our group is actually working on algorithmic ways to approach it that can be more scalable. Other groups are too, but you can fix it if you know to look. Problem comes if you just have inattention and you just trust the process too much, where you don't care to even look and ensure that it really is a fair process for everyone. That's the problem. And once you identify problems, they can be fixed. We just have to care enough. We have to be conscientious enough. We have to have the forethought to realize that there are people that are different than us.
Yeah.
And that there are domains that we haven't seen that are important too. So it is a statement of values to say that there's this algorithm that works on people that I care about, but there are people that are important too that maybe aren't in my view. That's a value statement, right?
Yeah. And so since it is a machine, we should be able to build it or code it to be all inclusive. We can program it.
Yeah. Well, the thing about it is that the algorithms are very neutral. They just try to optimize what we tell it to optimize. Correct. And if we don't tell it to optimize for everyone, it'll just optimize for the dominant group.
Yeah.
It becomes a tyranny of the majority.
I'm so happy that it's becoming in the forefront. Like we're aware of it now. We know that it's happening. And so now we can actually, you and your group, you can actually start finding a solution.
Yeah, well, like I said, the solutions are there. I'll send you a link to the article when it comes out. Or you can send me an email reminding me. But the key point, though, is it is really an orientational problem of, you know, as computer science scientists or programmers write artificial intelligence code, they have to decide if they're going to be engineers or if they're going to be scientists. And I think, you know, the engineer is just trying to this is an analogy that maybe some engineers may not like, but just go with me for what I'm trying to get at and what I mean here. It's to kind of meet some very clearly defined, predetermined, you know, error tolerances to say that, you know, you've really met, you know, the minimum level of performance by AUC or whatever to be a useful program and you send it out into the world. Mm-hmm. That's one way to do it. And you're okay with it being a black box if it actually hit the minimum requirements. That's not how a scientist thinks. The word for science actually means understanding. That's actually the root Latin word which we get the word science from.
Right.
The scientist wants to understand. It's not enough to meet some minimal performance requirements or even slightly more extensive performance requirements. We want to understand. And so we're sitting there asking the question of like, well, this isn't in the requirements, but what about this? Will it work in this context?
Mm-hmm.
And to really be curious that way. The thing about it is that sort of scientific inquiry is at odds and in competition with some business concerns.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
And that's why science has always had a complex relationship with business, where we are engaged with business, but we're not business itself, right? We're engaged with engineering, but not engineering itself. We want to actually understand, even if understanding might, at least in the short run, undermine some business interests. We really want to understand. So we'll do things like actually really look for rare side effects in a drug, because we want to make sure we're not putting out a drug that really hurts people. And we'll do that even beyond what the FDA requires sometimes. Right.
Yeah. And that's the human part of it. That's what we want to hear. like somebody is out there taking that in consideration, because a lot of us are walking around and don't know that we are the product.
Well, your language is, I think, exactly right on. You said that's the human part of it. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to, for example, developing drugs, people have a lot of issues with drug development. But I'll tell you what, there's a high degree of conscientiousness and concern beyond what the FDA requires among many people in that industry. And certainly among academics that are working in that area, they want to do what's right for the patient and that's going to serve them. Mm-hmm. That's at least what the best of them do. And not to say that there aren't bad actors, there can be. People make mistakes. And there's a lot of people looking, right? But there is that deep sense of professional ethics that every physician has. When you go to a physician, you know that even if, you know, the hospital administrator tries to interfere, that physician has a clear personal sense of wanting to take care of you, the patient, right?
Right.
It's personal, but it goes beyond personal, because even if you've never met the doctor, you know that's true, because it's a professional ethic, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have that same thing when it comes to machine learning. We know what we think is true, that the majority of people working on mining the data at Facebook, their loyalties lie primarily with Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And Facebook's loyalties lie primarily with their stockholders.
Right.
And there isn't the same professional ethic that comes in of like, you know, I'm doing science here. That is for the good of humanity. And that's in tension with what my employer wants. So I can do things that are going to serve the employer, but I also want to really understand, and I want to do what's going to serve society. And I think AI, to be good AI, for it to be the best of what humans can bring to the world, it really needs to develop that professional ethic. And forward-thinking companies are going to be thinking through how they can cultivate that sort of ethic that's actually bigger than themselves.
Mm-hmm. They're growing massively, and they're becoming too big to even penetrate or even consider, because I was blown away at how the amount of data that is gathered upon us, like Google and, you know, Facebook, the data that they get up on us, that they're predicting our behaviors with that data. I'm blown away by that. And you wonder, we're unaware. A lot of people are unaware that this is happening.
Yeah, so one way to deal with this is by to try opt out of it. That's not very effective, frankly. That actually has come some major downsides. You can try to disallow it, but the fact of the matter is that's totally unenforceable. And in fact, that's how a lot of good could come.
That's what I'm saying. It's already too big. It's already grown so much that how do you make it? How do you make a difference? How do you even?
Well, so like if you go, it's like I'm a physician too, right? You know, I don't treat patients now, but you know, I went to medical school and for a while I did. You know, we get access to very personal, private information. And we get access to the bodies of patients. We have ability to do great harm and great good with the actual bodies of patients too, right? And the reason why the public trusts physicians for the most part is for the most part, we have taken that to be an incredibly high calling and responsibility that transcends our employment. Mm-hmm. Like if any of us were convinced that our employers were doing serious harm to patients, especially if that was happening intentionally and they were unwilling to correct it, you know, we as a matter of conscience would leave. I mean, that's what would happen, right?
Yeah.
So there's actually only so much that a hospital or, you know, other employer can do of damage because we actually deeply care about patients that way for the most part. I'm not saying that there isn't bad apple doctors. There are.
But as a physician, though, we're talking about addiction, right? Like the social media, the algorithm, the way it is set up, that it forces you to be addicted to wanting to check to get the dopamine release. When you get a like, when you get a post, when you get some engagement. And that can be hard to break because now they're messing with the psychology.
Yeah, so this is, I think, where it comes out, I think, for people working in the tech industry and also for the companies here. I think the companies are important, too. I mean, like, it took a lot of not just merely individuals acting well, but actually institutions working to create structures for this, right? You know, how do we actually create a good AI? How do we create a process where there's real professional ethics around this, professional pride in doing good, and professional responsibility to prevent bad, where we really want to understand what we're doing in society?
Yeah.
And to really recognize that we can unintentionally put out very harmful things that have unintended consequences. That's just a fact of the world. I mean, you don't have to be a racist forward software that could have profoundly racist consequences. Mm-hmm. There's an example that happened that was important where there was a machine learning used to kind of do recommendations within an app for what types of businesses would be good and useful to a person. And in certain parts of our country, like for example, in St. Louis, there's a very stark racial divide. Mm-hmm. There are certain neighborhoods that are Black that are literally like a walk away across the street and it's like a white neighborhood, right? The algorithms were learning the divides and only recommending people to go to places in the white neighborhood, not because of it had determined that the Black areas in the Black neighborhood were inherently worse, but just that they were trafficked less. So it was just sending people to the places that were trafficked more. And that ended up amplifying divides, right?
Yeah.
And it has an impact on school systems because now there's less taxes going to these places. And so this app was actually creating the exact segregation that Martin Luther King marched against.
I know.
Not because the people who programmed it were racist. And I think that's a very important thing. These were not KKK Ku Klux Klanners going out there trying to injure Black neighborhoods. That's not what was happening. It was just inattention and a lack of understanding. And that's what it did.
What do we do? Because the machine is learning. It's learning from our behavior. Do we change our behavior then?
Well, no. So what you do then, like in that case, is you can look at that situation and say, oh, I created a software that's rewarding something that is actually not good for society. And it's probably even impacting my customers in a negative way. I mean, and frankly, you know, when you think about it, when it comes to recommending people a restaurant, sometimes you want to go to the well-trafficked places. But, you know, you sometimes want to discover the forgotten gem.
A hole in the wall.
Mm-hmm. And you also sometimes want to, as a matter of ethics, even go into neighborhoods that have been neglected and serve them by getting a meal there. Mm-hmm. It's very easy when you kind of put those two things together that they can actually serve their patients. I mean, not their patients. I'm thinking as a physician. They could just serve their customers better by bringing these things to the surface more, creating different ways for them to be exposed to stuff in a way that wouldn't impact them if they wanted to continue going to that white neighborhood.
Yeah.
But would also kind of expose them to these realities to actually introduce those often Black owners to whole new markets and to really privilege them in a place where they had been unintentionally disprivileged, right?
Right.
I think this is one of the key aspects when it comes to really reforming society. We have to understand that we participate unaware in sustaining real injustice in the world. And it's unaware. That is a fundamental fact. So it's not that people are out there racist often. I mean, there are racists out there that are sustaining this stuff. But if we don't understand, we'll just continue this.
Yeah. Is that your intention with Peaceful Science?
Hey, with Peaceful Science, so I founded Peaceful Sciences. It's a group of scientists of religious or non-religious backgrounds that want to do a better job building trust between scientists and the general public. And we want to increase understanding in areas that we really studied a lot. You know, I studied artificial intelligence a lot. Another place where I've done a lot of work, I recently published a book on, is in Human Origins. It's called The Genealogical Adam and Eve. Looking at what population genetics really tells us about human origins and how that interacts with what the religious public thinks about it. Another place where there's a large need for trust to be built. You could look across so many domains in society where you could see we're just really suffering because scientists are not well-trusted, and we haven't done a good job building trust to do this. And we haven't always acted in a trustworthy way either.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we want to do better at Peaceful Science. We want to create a way for scientists to have more trust and to be more trustworthy in engaging the public.
That's good to know. Bridging the gap between the two. Now, a step further, how about science and spirituality? How do you bridge that gap?
Well, you know, I think that there's a large number of Christians that care about, or Muslims or Jewish people or Hindus that care about real, you know, scientific questions, right? And as scientists, we have to remember that the scientific work we do really touches on grander questions that people have been asking about long before science existed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we do a disservice to the science, and we do a disservice to the public that funds science when we're not engaged with those questions in a sensitive way. It's not that science gives us the whole story, but it sometimes is relevant to these larger questions. And we can be better at thinking about how to engage those questions in a way that's true to the science. And it's also engages concerns outside of science.
You also have the flip side, where you have spiritual people, you have Christians that don't want to take science into consideration too.
So my experience with that is that a lot of the religious community that is called anti-science, they are very disaffected. There's been a break of trust for a whole host of reasons. And it's a two-way thing. There's been real mistakes made in those communities at times, but also scientists can do better engaging them with more empathy towards their questions. So we can't change what the answers of what science gives, but sometimes we find out that religious communities have cared about are different and distinct from what actually science says, even though it uses the same name. And a great example of this that came up in Human Origins was that, you know, a lot of religious communities were really asking questions about human origins and about what humans are and when they arise in history. But a little known fact among people outside of science, which is very clear to people who work in anthropology, is that we don't actually have a good definition of science, of what science is. I mean, sorry, what human is. And so you can't really ask the question or answer, give a sensible answer of what human is unless you actually have a clear answer on what human is. You don't know when they arise if you don't know what they are. And we can talk about Homo sapiens, and sometimes people refer to that as human, but that's not actually what theologians and people of faith were really caring about. They meant something different. And there isn't actually a good correspondence between what the religious community cared about when they were talking about human and what scientists mean when they talk about human. And so with sensitivity, that difference of meaning, it turns out maybe there's a lot less conflict.
Yeah. And then when you bring in the notion of spirituality and universe and how a bundle of energy and infinite intelligence, right? That's a new term. That's a different term for it. When you think about that, there's an ultimate goal, a humanistic goal, right? It's to be loved. It's to love, and it's to contribute. It's to add value. It's to give back. And then believing in that higher.
You're talking about like a humanistic value, which is a great way to put it. But here's a key thing that I think a lot of scientists who are often atheists and humanists sometimes forget. Science doesn't actually bring us to humanist values, that direction. Like, that's a place where science can't bring us there. It tells us a lot of useful things about the world. But when we come with a value of wanting to use our science to serve the world, to serve humanity, and to make the world a better place, that's us adding something really important and valuable to the science that isn't actually science itself.
Intriguing. So find a way to marry the two.
Well, we do it all the time. I think what it comes down to is that we're in a very divided, broken society where people disagree, and the disagreements have really grown into injuries. And we just need to get better at talking to people we disagree with across those disagreements. And even with scientists, talking to people who disagree with us on science. Yeah. And try to build trust across those divides. That's the task. That's the task of what it means to seek peace in a divided world.
Well put. Talk to somebody with a different idea, different opinion. Follow somebody with a different idea, and different opinion, because you don't want to get stuck in your own thinking either. You don't want to get stagnant. Well put, Dr. Joshua. Now, I have to ask, how do you get up, dress up, and show up? You know, how do you prep yourself to get as a physician, as a scientist? What's your morning routine like?
So I have small kids. So my morning routine is that my five-year-old, so one of my kids is too young. He's in a crib, so he's trapped in the morning. But my five-year-old gets up before anyone else, and usually before he's allowed to, and squeezes into bed between my wife and I. And so our morning routine is having like a rowdy little five-year-old in our bed, reminding us that we're part of a family. We're connected to one another, and the day has begun. And at times frustrating and maddening, and at the same time, it's also beautiful and good to know that there is people in this world waiting for us to wake up.
Yeah, keeping you grounded.
And we're connected, yeah. So I think that is an involuntary aspect of my morning routine right now that I probably would not choose, but it's also deeply good.
Yeah. Yeah. And in terms of content, what are you consuming? You know, what you're doing in here and do in the first 10 minutes.
Yeah. So I'm going to say something that might be surprising to a lot of people, but I don't eat breakfast intentionally for health reasons, actually. There's some people said that eating breakfast is healthy, but intermittent fasting, there's an immense amount of work done on it. So for the most, I only eat within an 8-hour period between noon and 8 p.m. That's when I consume the vast majority of my calories. And then so in the mornings, I'm fasting.
Yeah. No, I'm consuming content, but that's good. Intermittent fasting is good as well. But I'm looking for successful trait habits that actually kind of help you to stay sharp, help you to thrive and beyond.
So I'm atypical in this too, in that I found out when I was a medical doctor that there's actually a medical condition. It's called the delayed sleep syndrome. So it's kind of like I'm perpetually jet lagged. And my most productive times are actually late at night. And so not everyone is this way. Some people are not. It's one of the reasons why I would not make a very good physician, because it's on a very tight schedule that starts early in the morning. I mean, that's hard. And that's one of the reasons why being a scientist has been great, is that you can do work in a very shifted schedule like that. And it made me really effective in that. And so one thing that I had to learn is that I could be okay with being different that way. Mm. That not every highly functioning, highly productive, highly effective person is getting up at like 5 a.m.
Yeah.
You know, running around the block and doing that. So a lot of people are. I mean, there's a particular culture around that, and it makes sense. I have an immense amount of respect for it, but not everyone's biology works that way. My biology doesn't. I'm never at my best early in the morning. I'm always at my best later at night.
Yeah, there is what we call the chronotype. You have to be able to work with your internal circadian, internal clock, because it varies from person to person. And so there are some people like yourself, their most productive hours are between 5 p.m. and midnight. You know, that's when the juices are flowing, and going to bed at midnight and waking up a little later, 7-8 o'clock in the morning. But I do tell people that come on the show, they do identify and say, you know, I'm not up at 4 a.m. like everyone else. And that is perfectly okay, because your body is different. Yeah. You got to learn to work with it and not against it. And that's why when you mentioned that, it actually confirms that as a physician, that is normal.
A lot of people do consider me a high-performing person. What's interesting is that there's so many stereotypes around this, though, that when they look at my CV and my productivity, they see me as a very high-performing person. And their assumption is that I'm living kind of that stereotypical getting up at 4 a.m., not sleeping, all that sort of stuff. And also, I know at times, because I just work differently, I've been prejudged. And I think that's unfortunate for me, but I do think it's really important, honestly, in a business context too, to make sure that you're not missing out on opportunities with particular employees to perform at the best by prejudging them this way. Sometimes some flexibility can really dramatically improve productivity.
And it happens in corporate America. It happens in the workplace quite often, more frequently than we think, because of this structured 9-to-5, expecting everyone to be on the same cycle, expecting everyone to work between those hours, where in reality it's not the case. Productivity increased a lot more when people were working at home during the
I mean, I think it's complicated. Some people, the productivity went really down. And certainly I have employees that I'm working with. Some of them has been very difficult too. I think the fact of the matter is, though, is that especially the highest performing people, we tend to be somewhat idiosyncratic, I have to say, as I look around some of the highest performing people. Mm-hmm. And almost all of us have really benefited from the degree of flexibility to kind of conform our work context to a place where we can be most productive.
Yeah.
And I used to be kind of caught up and hung up on the fact that I wasn't a morning person. I am like a type A driven personality in a lot of ways, but I wasn't a morning person. And there's a point I just have to realize that, you know, it's okay. And that's why, you know, yeah. And I'm okay with it now.
What are some of your habits then? What are some of the habits that you can contribute to your success, to your productivity, that are unique to you?
Yeah. So a key part of it has been, well, you know, having small kids, that was a big change. So making sure I had time to actually come into the office instead of just working from home all the time. And I was fortunate to be able to do that even during COVID is important, right? Another thing too, honestly, I kind of embracing my night owlness, you know, on top of running an NIH funded group, being a professor, I wrote a book for the public, which is something you're not supposed to do. You know, I wrote this book. Most of that book was written actually after 10 p.m. My most productive time, when, you know, all the kids and the wife and everyone is in bed, don't get any important emails like flooding my inbox and nothing happening, was really from like 10 p.m. to about 4 a.m. And so that 6 hours was just a golden time for doing an immense amount of work. I mean, not just about my book, but also for my scientific work as well.
So you're going to sleep at 5 a.m. waking up. What time are you waking up?
Well, if I go to sleep, I mean, I'm not always going to bed at 4 a.m. or there have been long stretches when I'll do that. And if I'll do that, I might be getting up at noon. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that, right?
Yeah, no.
And that's why they call it a delayed sleep schedule, is because, like, that's, you know, kind of like everything has kind of just shifted over. It's kind of like you're living in a different time zone.
Yeah.
I don't do that all the time. I'm not doing that right now. But that's actually the time zone shift in which I'm, like, easily the most productive.
Yeah.
I mean, it's no contest. I'm the most productive in that way.
Like I said, yeah, there are individuals that it does happen that the hours are different. You got to know when you're at your peak to perform and to get that work done.
And the key thing isn't just about the hours in that case. It's just all the distractions are gone at that point, right? My kids are asleep. My wife is asleep. There's no social events planned during that time, at least not at my age.
You know, right.
I'm in my 40s now. Maybe when I was in high school, there would be a midnight event, but not now, right?
Yeah. We went a little bit over, and I wanted to give you a second to let us know how we can find your book and connect with you.
Oh, yeah. You can find me at peacefulscience.org. You sign up the mailing list if you want to know more and explore the articles there. And if you want to read my book and you have questions about human origins, it's The Genealogical Adam and Eve, published in 2019. You can get it on Amazon, and hopefully it's helpful to you.
Perfect. Yeah, we'll put that on the show notes there. Thank you for sharing that information. Very insightful.
All right, morning enthusiasts. That's it for today's show. Thank you for tuning in. If you love the Best Morning Routine Ever podcast, we'd love to hear from you. So go ahead and subscribe, rate, and give a review on iTunes or Google Play. While you're at it, tell a friend about the show. Be sure to visit bestmorningroutineever.com and our Facebook group to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover our fantastic free bonus content. Until next time.